Well, as I said, Michelle and I, we really did have a wonderful feast this year. First time we've been to the feast in Ghana, although I've traveled to Ghana at various times. First time we've ever even been in Togo, and Kasi Fiabwe, our elder there, the first time we've ever personally met him and had a chance to be together. Delightful, pleasant individual, cares for two congregations, totally self-supported, and very much a servant. It was just a wonderful blessing to get to know, again, one more individual that serves together with us in the work. Ghana had 39 in attendance. Togo had 51. Both were up just a little bit in attendance from last year, but those numbers are fairly stable. The difference would be who the guests were possibly at each site. But like I said, Ghana's on the Volta River. Lake Volta starts at the dam that was literally at the city where the feast was held. Lake Volta is the largest man-made lake in the world. It stretches 250 miles back through Ghana. Now, you would think to make a lake 250 miles long, the dam would have to be a couple thousand feet high. The only thing I can say is the topography of Ghana is very unique. The land has to be very, very level in terms of elevation, but it has ridges and structure such that you can literally dam up the river and run the lake back. The dam's not more than 300 feet high, and the lake behind is 250 miles long. So it's not like it's a prairie, but it's a nation that is fairly flat with very high ridge lines. And so it actually works and makes a very great resource for that country. Where we were at the feast in Togo wasn't something that I think I could describe in terms of the geography. But just outside of town, there was a waterfall, and it was the Cascade de Pime, or Pima, whatever it was. I see it printed. I wrote it down, but I should have asked how to pronounce it. But anyway, it was a big waterfall coming off of a breach there on the side of a long lake up top coming down over the cascade of the rockfall. And it was fun to go there as an activity. We had three baptisms that we did at the base as the water flowed out from where the waterfall was. And we also ordained a deacon in Togo while we were there this year. But it was, again, the picture that did come out this time as I had a camera to be able to take it was Michelle walking down to the base of the waterfall and all of these young people down there standing as the water is pouring down and splattering off of the rocks. They're standing in the mist and Michelle is there and they're all jumping up and down. And again, it was I didn't go there. I am more mature than that. But, you know, she had a wonderful splash with all of the young people down there in the waterfall. It was a wonderful atmosphere. It was God's people. Dari was responsible for Nigeria and Benin. There were two baptisms there. Mabut, as I mentioned, I think, previously, but he was in atonement, in Congo for atonement. In Ivory Coast, he spent the entire feast there. And the situation there in Congo is a little bit different than the fact that we were in Ghana and attendance was up a little tiny bit, and we were in Togo and attendance was up a little tiny bit. When you go to Congo, attendance was down. In fact, it was down fairly significantly. Last year, we had 52 in Congo. This year, we had 35. And it's an interesting thing. It seems to be the way of man. It certainly is the way of man sometimes in the church. It always sounds better when the numbers are up, right? I mean, we measure things by the numbers. What was the response to the program? How many magazines go out? What kind of calls are coming in? How many new people have you met? We measure things by the numbers. And when the numbers are up, we're excited. When the numbers are down, we're going, oh, no, what happened? And so in that sense, Congo, the numbers went the other way. And it is the usual story. Somebody wanted to be the leader. We chose someone else. And they took all their marbles and went home. Now, when I was a kid, we played marbles. Now, they're thousands of years old, and so just because the kids today don't play marbles doesn't mean they won't be available in the future. You know, they're probably going to outlast the iPhone. But when we were kids, we played marbles. In a grade school, out in the sand, you drew a circle, and you had your bag of marbles and your taw, your very special shooter, and you get down there, and you'd put your knuckle in the sand, and you'd flick that taw, and you get to where you could bang a marble and knock it out of the circle. And then you'd get to shoot again. Now, I'm sure there's a thousand derivations of marbles and what the rules would be. The point is, you're supposed to agree on the rules before the game as compared to argue about the rules afterwards. Oh, no, you can't take my taw. You left it in the circle. It's mine. So when somebody gets upset and doesn't like the game or the fact that they're losing their marbles, can you imagine where that came from? They pick up their marbles and they go home. And that came from, again, the game. We all saw it play out in various aspects. The marbles in this case was an individual, his family, his family's family. Because Africa is very patriarchal in that sense. The older you are and the more authority you have, the more financial control you have over those who look to you for support. And if you're a young adult living at home until you get established, which means you might be at home until you're 30, till you can get a job and be on your own and have your own place, you might be at home until you're 30 before you could even have an opportunity to think about marriage. And you know, Megan came out of college, went through college early, got married, and went on her way. In the United States, that's possible. Dari is even amazed at the culture in the United States of hitchhiking. And whereas it's not as prevalent today as it was when I was, again, younger, the hitchhikers, you could go on the road, hang your thumb out, and you were on the road going somewhere. And when you got there, you could go find a job. You could go to work at a Burger King. Of course, then that's more recent. You know, McDonald's would go back a little further. But you could find something to do and make your own way. And Africa's not built like that. Africa's built where you need to be under somebody's protection, basically, or care or assistance. And you need to have a network. So when someone at the top of the network walks out the door, in some respects, the people that are within that network have to walk with them. You can say, well, why don't they just put God first? Well, you know, we never do quite know who is really putting God first and who is not, do we? God knows. But the fact is, in the midst of the church, there's always going to be somebody who walked in the door who was brought not by God and calling, but turned in by Satan, in a sense, to cause disruption or trouble. And there's no way always to sort those out. In part, you sort that out by saying, well, who's left in the end? Faithful, who truly understands what we're called to do in the end. So we had a network of individuals walk out the door in Congo this year. They took their marbles, in that sense, and went home. Those who were there that we were using in a leadership position did not receive an office as high as they desired, and they simply went their way. Now, the marbles in Africa always include some of the bank account, too. The marbles are in the bank account. So we lost a little of the account, which is always what happens. It's what's happened in Ghana. It's what's happened in Nigeria. That's what's happened in Congo. It's happened in Congo more than once. And you can't just go to Africa, tell everybody to be well fed and nourished, and then walk away. Developing the leadership, supporting the leadership, going to visit and encourage the leadership and the members is very, very important. And we do. To the degree we're able, we continue on that way. But we're supposed to be in response to God's calling, because we're here not for what's in it for us, but for what we can literally do in service to others. That's the point. We're supposed to be servants, not be served, not be wanting power or authority or control, not for wanting everybody's marbles to be in our bag. Look at Mark chapter 9 and verse number 33. Just conceptually, a reminder, what it is that we were called to do. Mark 9, verse 33. Jesus Christ here came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, the disciples, "What was it you disputed about yourselves on the road?" And they kept silent, for on the road they had been disputing about who would be the greatest. And they didn't really want to say that that's what the argument had been about. He sat down, called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." And he took a little child and set them in the midst of them, and when he had taken them in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." Trying to teach them a lesson that we in some ways need to be childlike in the way we see ourselves. A child doesn't look at himself as a college student or as a business executive or as the leader of the congregation or as the one who's going to tell his children what to do. He may have his own wishes and desires, and it's only an analogy. It doesn't mean to represent all things. But a child knows that he's a child. He's small. And Christ is just saying we need not to look at ourselves as if we are some big thing. And we certainly should not be looking at others as if they should serve us as well. We should truly want to be a servant. Think of the difference between someone who is a servant because they have to be and someone who is a servant because they choose. Well, there's a big difference in attitude and approach. You know, Michelle made an interesting observation this year. Well, 10 years ago, 9 or 10, whenever it was when we first went to Africa, we kept the feast to begin with in Oweri. And Oweri had the 200 people I've mentioned before that all walked in the door together from another organization and from various villages, and they had different leaders, and they all came flooding in the door. They're all sitting there together, and we had brought some gifts for the feast, and Michelle had kind of organized and arranged, but we had like pens and pads and things to give out to the various people. And as she would give them out, and then other people would come back up, and they would say, "Well, I didn't get any, or I need one for so-and-so, or they took mine." There were people that were literally in competition to get as many of the gifts as they could. There were people there that were even lying about what they had received or not received in order to get something they wanted. There were things we gave to the children that the adults were fighting over. There were things we gave to the children that the adults took away from the children and kept for themselves. And it was kind of a object lesson. You begin to wonder, what this is going to be? Well, what it was a group of people that all of them, quite frankly, were not being called into the church. They'd walked in the door to get something, to get an opportunity, a gift, connection to the United States, support, financial support, authority. Their leaders, in some cases, wanted authority. So over time, as we began to teach them what true Christianity really was and what the obligations of it that went along with it would be, they began to thin out. There were some people we told to just go away. There were leaders that we replaced with other leaders, and then they left. That's what happens. If you want to be the leader and you don't get to be the leader and someone else is picked, you basically get, again, you take your marbles and you go home because you're not there for the right reason. But this year, as we were there and having activities, and it was interesting, because, again, pens and pads, the Kiesels had brought some remarkably nice gifts that could be shared to all these different feast sites, and we took them with us when we went to Togo, and we gave them out and passed them around, and that was it. Everyone was quiet. Everybody got one, and they were pleased. Nobody was running around grabbing them from the children, because the children had no authority. At least I didn't see that. But it was peaceful, and it was organized and orderly. And then Michelle had an activity on making jewelry. And she had brought the supplies when the women's retreat had the yard sale. There were big bags of plastic beads. They were very simple beads. They were not exotic beads. But Michelle had the wires and the clippers and the hooks and everything, and you could make a necklace or bracelet or earrings. And you had all, again, mostly all these women and children. We started with that because they would have the most utility of that type of thing. Showed a couple of the men how to help with the wires and trim and secure the clasps on. And so we had this activity where you just took thousands of these beads and spread them out on table in a big pile and then showed everybody what we were going to be doing. And they all had to kind of wait in order and to get a chance and someone to help them. But they listened and learned, and the men went around and helped, showed the women how to do it. The women then took and began to show the kids, and pretty soon the women were helping each other. And Michelle just said, this is so different than Oweri. And what it was, God's Spirit was here. This wasn't just another culture. This was a different influence. And that competition and that one-upsmanship and that I want mine and I want more was not even there. And so in an environment where you really didn't have the time to organize everything the way it maybe could have been ultimately, and you had to set these out in piles of beads on the desk where people could then go through and sort, find what they wanted, everybody kind of was happy and encouraging and sharing, and there was no disorder, and Michelle could sit at a table and help. It was wonderful. It was the difference between God's Spirit being in their midst. Some of these were children and ladies in some cases that were not even converted, but they were part of the congregation. They were part of the body. And there was a difference. In fact, the difference was dramatic. It was a lesson. It was a real lesson to see it in play. In the book of Numbers, chapter 14, verse number 19, I'm coming. We have Moses here interceding for Israel because Israel, as their custom was, had not been responsive to God. And Moses is interceding on their behalf. But in verse 19 it says, pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, Moses saying, according to the greatness of your mercy, even as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. And the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word. Pardon doesn't mean he forgave them of sin. The blood of Jesus Christ forgives, is applied towards sin. What God was just saying is he's working with Israel in terms of blessings and curses. And when they would obey him, he would bless them. And when they would disobey him or turn against him, he would punish them. He says, okay, I'm removing the punishment right now, the penalty, in a specific way. Obviously, Israel, in some case, had to ultimately wait, couldn't enter the promised land, and yet their children did. But he says, I've pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. Even though they don't see it, I am God, and my glory will fill the earth. Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. So he didn't kill them, but he said, you will not enter the promise. They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But notice verse 24. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I'll bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it. So this is actually a type of having a different spirit and receiving the promise, which is the kingdom of God ultimately. That's what the promised land portrayed. And those without that spirit fell in the wilderness and died. And so it talks about here, again, what it's like to be part of God's body, having his spirit, having a different focus. 1 Samuel 10, verse number 1, is a different example. We now have where Saul is to be anointed as king. Verse 1 says, Samuel took a flask of oil, poured it on his head, kissed him, and said, is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance? When you have departed from me today, you'll find two men. He begins to give him some instructions on how he should go forward and what he's supposed to do, and it plays out for a few verses. But verse 4, he says, they will greet you, these men that you're going to meet, and give you 2 loaves of bread, which you shall receive from their hands. Verse 5. After that, you shall come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is, and it will happen when you have come there to the city that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with a stringed instrument, a tambourine, a flute, and a harp before them, and they will be prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you, and you will prophesy with them and be turned into another man. You're going to be turned into another man. You're going to be totally different when God's Spirit comes upon you. And so it's, again, there's another example, just a reference to the fact that when God's Spirit's there, things are different. The people are different. The response is different. We go to Africa to serve the members who are there in the best way that we can. And while we're there, those that God is working with are trying to serve us in the same way. We always bring back few bags of peanuts when we're traveling. And, you know, you think, well, what is one of the main things you'd want to have in Africa? Well, peanuts. We do. We bring back gallon bags of roasted peanuts. Now, in this case, we had the Kiesels, and they wanted 3 bags because we told them how good this was. And Dolores wanted 2 bags because we told her how good this was. And we wanted 3 bags. Now, we're talking 8 gallon bags of roasted peanuts. Well, in Nigeria, you go up to little kids on the street, and they've got them in whiskey bottles. That's what they sell them in. And you just pour them out of the bottle, and he takes them, you know, Dar eventually takes the bottles back to some other kid to refill or whatever. But we pour them into the Ziploc bags, and we bring them home. But Henry and Hannah, again, Akins, he's one of our elders there, was going to get them for us. And I said, look, Henry, just buy the peanuts. I said, buy a bunch. We'll put them in the bags. We'll take them home. Well, they got to looking at what the cost of that was going to be. We're talking quite a few bottles of peanuts here. And they didn't really want us to have to spend that much money. So what they did was they went out and they bought these peanuts in bulk, which means in the shell. Now, they didn't roast them, did they, honey? Weren't they already cooked? I don't know. When you roast them, they get little brown spots on them, and you actually heat them in a pan. But they literally got the family together on the day that we were coming back from Togo and spent the entire day, the whole family, shelling peanuts. And I was embarrassed. I mean, that's a lot of work. You come visit my house, I'm not spending 10 hours shelling peanuts for you. I'm not going to do that. So I was embarrassed when I found out that, and Michelle's the one who figured it out. She got to listening to kind of just comments. They never really said. They just went and got peanuts, and it was very cheap. I said, man, it was awful cheap because I kind of know what they cost, and they didn't cost very much. And I thought, that's awful cheap. And, oh, yeah, we got a good price, you know. Michelle kind of figured out the day I sat there all day long. I mean, dawn to dusk, if you could, shelling these peanuts to save us a little money as a gift so that we could take them home to our friends. See, the United States peanuts have oil on them or sugar on them or starch on them or whatever, but they don't taste like a peanut. They taste like something, you know, manufactured out of a processing plant or something, rendering plant maybe. Yeah, maybe not that bad. But anyway, I was embarrassed, and I protested that they had worked so hard to do this for us as a favor. Henry was embarrassed that I was embarrassed, because that's what you do. You serve each other, and this was how they could serve us. We came there. This was something they could do, and literally he was embarrassed that I was embarrassed. But, again, it showed me and it reminded me that we didn't want to take advantage of them. We wanted to serve them, but they didn't want to take advantage of us. They wanted to serve us. And it was an interesting thing to stop and step back and say, you know what? That's just God's Spirit working. That's just the effort, the desire of each other to kind of look out for the interests of others. So anyway, if you're interested in having one or two peanuts, talk to Michelle. She'll mail them to you in an envelope or something. But she uses them and gives them out. And, you know, every time I go back, we have to recharge the peanut supply in the house. If you really want to be a servant, there's hope. Because you can't just be a servant because you have no choice. What's it like when you have to do something because someone said, I told you to do that. You have to do that. You owe me. You know, you maybe do it or carry it out or, oh, look, I'm paying you. You get your job done. Okay, you get it done maybe. But what happens when you really want to do that job? Change your whole attitude and approach. In this life, we are to be servants, called of God to serve one another in that way. And you have to want to do it. If you're doing it because you have to, if you're doing it because if you don't, you won't be in the kingdom. Well, then you're not going to be there anyway yet, because that's simply not the way it works. 1 Samuel 16, verse number 1. It says, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I've rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I'm sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite. I have provided myself a king among his sons. Now the story plays out, and Samuel is very concerned that he would be in danger to do so. God said, just do what I say. I will take care of you. So, verse 4, Samuel did what the Lord said. He went to Bethlehem. The elders of the town trembled at his coming. Do you come peaceably? He said, peaceably, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. There he sanctified Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Now it was when they came, he looked at Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Here's this great, big, handsome, tall, you know, rugged, possibly individual, good appearance. The Lord said to Samuel, don't look on his appearance or the height of his stature. I have refused him. The Lord does not see as man sees. The Lord looks, man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. So Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. He said, neither has the Lord chosen this one. And it went through some of the children. He's going through. Finally, he says, verse 10, Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. Samuel said, Jesse, are all the young men here? Well, there remains yet the youngest. There he is out there keeping the sheep. Samuel said, Jesse, send and bring him. We will not sit down until he comes. So he sent and brought him in. He was ruddy, bright eyes, good looking. But he was the youngest and the smallest in that way. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him. This is the one. Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. And effectively, you could say, and he was a changed young man. So, David was out, what? He was the least of the servants, the least of the brothers. He was the one left to take care of the cats and the coats at the door while everybody else went to the banquet. And so, in doing, though, David learned some lessons in a way that he might not have learned had he not had such an opportunity. Think about David being the one that had to go out and constantly shepherd the sheep while the other brothers got to do other bigger, better things. When David was out there, where do you think David slept? Yeah, on the ground, probably. There could have been a shack or something or a structure of some kind. There's no way to know for sure. But the honest answer, he was out there with the sheep, and sheep were out in the open on pasture. What did he eat? Fine meals, good wine. No, he probably ate something pretty simple and had to probably make it for himself. I mean, he lived simple. It's just, you can imagine if you're camping or something and you have to live in a very simple way. What did you think David did when it rained? You know, put on his Gore-Tex outfit probably and sat there under, you know, a shelter? Not necessarily. You know, Paul Moody and I were at the Challenger program when he went to Wyoming, because Paul attended both in Tucson and in Wyoming. And we were up scoping out some rock climbing sites on the top of a ridgeline, and a storm came up. And the wind's blowing and starts to rain, and finally it's hailing. Now, we're up there scrambling under a big rock, trying to find a rock big enough to sit there out of the storm, because we were out in the open. And we did. We kind of crawled in under some rock, and it hailed for a while, and then the storm was over, and then we came back out. But, you know, when you're out there, you're in it. You're going to sleep wherever you can sleep. You're going to eat what you can eat. You're going to get wet when it rains. You're going to be cold when it snows. You're going to get dirty when the wind blows. That's what it's all about. Actually, it's a pretty nice option if you can do it. But that's what David was doing. He was out with the sheep. And that's what God wanted. He wanted someone to learn the lessons of what it meant to take care of someone else. If you're not willing to be cold or wet or dirty, then keeping sheep is not for you. And if you think sheep are stupid, then keeping sheep is not for you. If you're going to be a shepherd, you have to be willing to care for the sheep and recognize the benefit and the value of the sheep. But to do it well, you got to want to do it. If you're there because you have no choice, then believe me, you're not going to pay attention. You're just not going to be on the job in the right way. On this last trip, everyone pretty much stayed well. Health is always an issue traveling here from the United States to Africa. It's an issue for those who are there, but it is a specific issue. And so when people talk to me about possibly going over there, when we've taken young adults for the youth programs, for the youth corps in the past, basically my advice is if you're worried about getting sick, stay home. If you want to go to the mall, they have one right here in town. If that's what you want, this is the place. If you're worried about getting sick, do not go there. Which doesn't mean you'll be sick if you do. It just means, you know what, that isn't going to be our highest focus. We're going to take care of ourselves, but we're there for a different reason. And you know what? You just might be sick along the way. Now, in this case, God blessed us. We did very well. I started out actually picked up a cough, I think, on the airplane going over. When I arrived in Ghana, I had some congestion. But I felt fine. And so when I would speak in church, I just said, look, I can't stretch my voice right now. We have to go to Togo, and I want to have enough left when we get there to finish the job. So I said, I'm going to speak kind of quiet, and I'll keep my voice low. And I did. And I explained it. Everybody understood. So when I spoke kind of slow, and I didn't raise my voice, which meant they could actually understand what I was saying, because that's what they would like me to do normally, but I don't. So it actually was a blessing and a benefit. But every day, you know, I would cough and hack and try to clear my throat a bit, and I was feeling the congestion slowly move down into my lungs, just day by day, a little bit further. Michelle said, how you doing? How you doing? Oh, I feel pretty good. It didn't feel bad, but it was moving. She would give me advice sometimes on good things to do for myself that I ignored. But she was right. There you go. There you go, Steve. I saw you get the elbow right there. It goes around. So finally, night before heading to Togo, I was anointed, and God healed me. And when I arrived and we arrived in Togo, I was perfectly fine. When we came back, then to Ghana, people commented, surprised at how much stronger I was on my return home. And that I could yell and scream and raise my voice and speak very fast, which they preferred I wouldn't. So I think they liked me sick. But, you know, it's an amazing thing. God just gave us exactly what we needed, and all of us were able to fulfill our responsibilities. And generally speaking, we all stayed well. You know, I used to pretty much just determined what it was I wanted to do and did it. Kind of lived my life that way, actually. I like that better than the way things currently are. I feel like today sometimes I have to actually ask for permission. You go to God, you hand him a slip. Here's what I want to do. Is this okay? Will you sign off on this? Will you let me go? Okay. Sometimes God says yes. It always works. Days of Limburg trip was amazing. The Ghana trip in December was not so good. But God works out his will. It fulfills his purpose. But David learned his lesson, and he learned, I believe, to depend on God keeping sheep out in the wilderness. When the wolves would come and attack and he had to defend them, or the bear, and he had to grab him by the hair of the chin and club him or whatever he did to take him out, I'd be saying, man, I hope that little baby cub, you know, he'd have mama come in and want to do that. But he learned some lessons that he just wouldn't have learned, you know, back at the compound, having the servants wash your feet. It wouldn't have been embedded in the same way. You couldn't have written Psalm 23 if you hadn't been out there living it and learning to trust God and looking to God in this way. You had to be a shepherd to understand what being a shepherd meant. So in Psalm 23, he wrote, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters." There's books on this. There's men that are women that have shepherded and know all the terms and how a sheep drinks and doesn't drink, and I don't know any of it. But I can read this. I can understand it from a perspective of a shepherd of sheep in a spiritual way, I suppose. He restores my soul, leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I don't think you could have written that if you hadn't been out there caring for the sheep. You had to really understand intimately what it was that God therefore intended. Jesus Christ is our example, both of someone who is a sheep in the flock, in the fold, but also of a shepherd that cares for those who need to have oversight and attention and have their needs met. So he chose David out of the sheepfold to be the shepherd of his people. Psalm 78, verse number 70. This is speaking, it's a very long psalm here, but it's talking about God's kindness and Israel's rebellion. But in verse 70, Psalm 78, says, "He also chose David his servant, and he took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes that had young, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people. Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and he guided them by the skillfulness of his hands." Those were lessons he learned in service. Again, if you're out there with the sheep and you say, "I am never going to do this again," your attitude is going to be different than if you're out there trying to contribute and to protect and to maintain. In our calling, we must want to be a servant. We need to desire it, to yearn for it, to seek out ways in which we can be. Again, if you want to do something, your attitude toward doing that is going to be different than if you don't, than if you're only doing it because it is something you're compelled to do, something that you're forced to do, something you're obligated to do. We were there on a long trip this time because of atonement. And so the Kiesels and Dolores actually came along with our schedule, and it made their feast trip just as long as our own. And altogether, it was about a 3-week trip. But we were there then for atonement. which is a way to contribute, to be able to cover services on a holy day as well. So Dari and Tone came over from Nigeria, and Henry and his family with four, and Hilarious is one of the members there that he picked his own name, Hilarious, and he is always smiling and laughing, and he's our translator when we go to Togo. He speaks the local tongue because his village is over by the border with Togo. And so the village environment and the culture and the language is shared in common. So he goes with us, and he's very pleasant to be with. And we had five in our party, so I think we had a dozen people sitting there at the table of the hotel where we were staying for atonement. Now, that morning, we had breakfast, but in the busyness of the day and the organizing things and whatever it was we had, we had skipped lunch. And now we're there an hour and a half before dinner, so there'd be plenty of time for them to go, you know, raise a chicken, kill a chicken, pluck the chicken, cook the chicken. I joke, but the honest answer is sometimes when you order a meal over there, you do wonder if they aren't raising whatever it is first to get ready. We had one meal in Nigeria, literally. I think it took 3 hours. 3 hours. We went into order. We sat there and ordered. They came out, took the order. They went back. Nothing. Sit there, you know, I don't know, an hour or so. After about an hour and a half, the cook comes out of the back with her meal, sits down in front of us, and eats with her helper staff. They sat down, they had their meal, and then we watched them, and then they left and they went away. And then we sat there. And you know, it was so often you'd send, you know, a signal flare up to see if, you know, there was cavalry on the horizon or something to save us. But 3 hours, finally, they got around to cooking our meal. Thought, well, that was nice. You know, we're going to give you a big tip. But hour and a half is not unusual. But we figured we're okay, you know. We told them we're here for dinner. We had this big group. We warned them in advance. We told them before we came who's coming, when we're going to be there, so it would be all set up. That doesn't matter over there. That's just too much information, you know, to give them those kind of details. So we sat there, and 4:30 went to 5, and 5 went to 5:30, and 5:30 went to 5:45, and then went to 5:55. Sundown in Africa around the equator is about the same time all year round because it's the equator, so the sundown's at 6 o'clock. At about 5:55, they brought Michelle's meal. And she's looking at it, and then, well, the two boys that are the Aiken sons, you know, the young teenage boys, they need a little food. So she's sharing with them, and, you know, to make sure they had some, and she ate some of hers. And I think maybe they brought one more meal to Janet, and I think Janet was sitting there staring at it. And then, you know, it's like the gong goes off at midnight, and you turn into a pumpkin. 6 o'clock, bang, and there was no more meals. And we're all sitting there, you know, looking at each other, kind of smiling. And finally, after 6, they started bringing out the meals, kind of one by one. And so now we're all sitting around the table, 12 of us. It's in atonement, big steaming meals in front of us, you know. Now you can't touch it. But they had to think we were completely crazy to sit there, order meals, wait. Once they deliver it, we won't eat it. And we sat there, but, you know, it was kind of humorous. It wasn't a big burden. We were doing something we wanted to do. We believed in it. We wanted to fast. We weren't fasting because we had no choice. Someone had a whip on our back. But we wanted the benefit of the lesson of that day. Finally, Michelle said, you know, I think they think maybe we're not too, you know, all here. You know, our marbles are gone as well. And she said, how about we just have them box all this up to go? So, because we're sitting there talking without touching now the food. And so we ended up boxing all to go just to not be embarrassed the staff because they did not understand. And we hauled it all and stored it and, I don't know, ate some of it the next evening after that. So we basically had 2 days of atonement this year. But it was not a burden. Nobody was angry. Nobody was frustrated. It wasn't like, yeah, you should have been here at this time or they should have done. No, we wanted to do atonement. We wanted to fast. We wanted God to bless our efforts to serve him. And you know what? It was a very light weight. It was a very small thing. Now, if that would have happened under any other set of circumstances where we would have had different expectations, you know, there'd been stuff flying maybe around the room. I mean, not by me, not moi. But it makes a difference when you want to serve in the church. And if you're only serving because somebody, you're embarrassed if you don't, or because somebody's looking, or because God's got a score sheet and he's keeping check, and you just want to get across the line, it's not going to work. You're going to be unhappy. You're going to resent it. You're going to become angry and embittered. And sooner or later, you're going to take your marbles and go home. And many have. Many have. Luke 22 is the account here of Christ preparing for the Passover. Luke 22 and verse number 14. It says, when the hour had come, he sat down, the 12 apostles with him. He said, with fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I'll no longer eat of it until it's fulfilled in the kingdom of God. So he wanted to be there, and he wanted to be with them, and he wanted to do these things and the symbols that it represented. It was important to him. So even though he's getting ready to die, his attention was on the disciples and getting them ready for what would then shortly take place. John 13 is an additional part of the account that relates to the foot washing. John 13 in verse number 3 says, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God, was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. Now, just as he wanted to keep the Passover and to present those symbols to the disciples, he wanted to do this as well. This is part of the same thing. He wanted to wash their feet. And he took a towel, and he girded himself, and he poured water in a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. And he began to explain to them the importance of it and the necessity of being able and willing not just to keep the ceremony, but to keep the intention, the attitude and approach. Verse 12, when he had washed their feet and taken his garments and sat down again, he said to them, do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. You'll be blessed. I'm not sure, maybe the King James even says, blessed you'll be if you do them. So, in the Bible, repeatedly, Christ is trying to show us, the Father is trying to teach us, we're not just supposed to be servants because it's an obligation or a duty or because what's required. It's because it's what we want. Our spirit should make us a different person. If it can make Saul a different person, certainly it'll work with us. As Paul says, I speak as a fool. Of course. It changes us in fundamental ways. Philippians 2 references the example of Jesus Christ, the fact that he came in the flesh and lived this life. Philippians 2 and verse 5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a servant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Even that kind of death. Even at that kind of price. Jesus Christ did not come to the earth and live and then die kicking and scratching and screaming. That's not how he went through this life. He didn't live and then die resentful and angry and bitter, upset about the missed potential, the opportunities that weren't his. He came and lived and died as a servant. Verse 19. I trust in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly, Paul speaking, that I may also may be encouraged when I know your state, for I have no one like-minded who will sincerely care for your state. All seek their own, not the things which are of Christ Jesus. But you know his proven character, that as a son with his father, he served with me in the gospel. It's the same thing. It's the same point. Therefore, I hope to send him at once as soon as I see how it goes with me. I trust in the Lord that I myself shall come to you shortly. You know, God gave us a responsibility, but he gave us the ability to fulfill it. It's like comparing a wherry at the beginning when people were there who had not been drawn by God's Spirit, and then comparing Togo when the people were there who had. And it made all the difference. They were changed. And again, not even those who had God's Spirit in them, but those who were in the midst of those who had God's Spirit in them, who had been called as well, sanctified in God's service. Even the children gave evidence of such character. Again, one of the most fundamental keys, I believe, to being a servant is being willing to do so, being happy to do so, desiring to do so. It takes away the compulsion of the obligation that remains, because there are indeed obligations that are required of us. Paul gives an example in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. In the terms of the preparation of a sacrifice that was an offering for God's people. 2 Corinthians 8, verse number 1. He said, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. He said, in their poverty, they gave. Not because I told them they had to, because they wanted to. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And this they did, not as we had hoped, but first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. He gave even more above and beyond than what Paul had imagined or expected. That's our calling, brethren. Romans 12. It is our calling to give ourselves willingly in God's service and in our care for one another. Romans 12. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, which is based on competition and strife, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, being a changed person, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So the feast this year for us was wonderful. It was reinforcement of who God's people really are and what they're like. And God has given us an amazing opportunity to mentor under Jesus Christ. And in caring for the sheep, then, as we have opportunity and responsibility, to also learn to shepherd.